Hi, this is Scott. I really appreciate our sponsors because they make the show possible. Today's show is sponsored by Telerik. Create compelling app experiences across any screen with the Telerik platform. Telerik's end-to-end platform uniquely combines industry-leading UI tools with cloud services to simplify the entire app development cycle. Telerik offers everything .NET developers need to build quality apps faster. Try it free at telerik.com/platform. That's telerik.com/platform.
From HanselMinutes.com, it's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 449. In this episode, Scott talks with musician Samus, a.k.a. Inongo Lumumba Kasongo, about balancing a music career and a Ph.D.
All right, it's time to turn up in this bitch.
Power ups. I landed my ship, you can call me Picard. Check to the left, but the tunnel is small. Find my room, already the problem is solved. I can make my whole body turn into a bar. Yeah, I'm on a rope, like I'm jelly or I'm margarine. And everywhere I go, literally gone for a spin. When I get a missile in the midst of the mission, I feel so divine, like I'm H to the Izzo. Better know your place if you get up in my grill. I've been a teacher, better lesson, like I'm really Miss Frizzle.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes. And on Skype right now, I am talking with Inongo Lumumba Kasongo, who is a fourth-year PhD student at Cornell in Science and Technology Studies. How are you?
I'm doing wonderfully. How are you?
I'm thrilled to talk to you right now because you are a double threat, triple threat, not just a PhD student, but also a very accomplished nerdcore musician.
Yes, thank you. I haven't formally been called the triple threat yet, but it's great to hear.
Yeah, you have a lot of things going on, and we only have so long to talk about it. So let's start with the PhD. Explain to me what this specialization is.
So it is the field of science and technology studies, and as we chatted about a little bit before, it's a little bit obscure, but essentially it's thinking about science and technology in different kinds of ways. So typically, these subjects have been looked at in sort of a black box. We take things for granted. We assume that science represents sort of an objective perspective. And this field is about tearing those ideas apart and thinking about how we even come to a place where we have those assumptions around science and technology. So my specific area of research is sound technologies and thinking about sort of the black boxes that exist there.
Now, sound technology itself is a pretty broad area. I mean, there's how our brains process it, how it's thought about as a physical or an aspect of physics. There's how computers think about sound. What aspects are you tearing down?
So I'm interested in thinking about how we talk about the idea of quality as it relates to sound. Specifically in my dissertation, what I'm thinking about is how individuals, in particular studio contexts, identify and determine what counts as good quality versus bad quality, and how that's actually very complex, and there's not sort of an easy way of parsing out what that means, and that it has different valences to different individuals. So really knowledge formation around sort of issues of determining how sound is evaluated.
So is that the sense of quality in that, you know, this is a quality recording, or I prefer the sound quality of a vacuum tube receiver versus a digital one, and all of those kinds of things?
Yeah, it's all of the below or all of the above. What I have already kind of looked at as it relates to my dissertation has focused a lot around sort of microphones and how individuals at studios will make determinations about, you know, how a microphone produces a better quality sound and where those assumptions are coming from. And a lot of it has to do with perceptions that are outside of sort of actually what the individual is hearing, and more, you know, what the sort of weight of the brand carries, like, oh, it's that type of microphone, therefore it must produce this kind of quality sound. And so I'm thinking about how those labels are attached to, you know, particular kinds of microphones.
Interesting. On the other side, not just microphones, but also headphones, there was an interesting blind study, I thought, just a few weeks ago about people heard that it was a Beats microphone and then suddenly they felt like it had better sound quality. But when they did a blind study, it was not.
Exactly. That's exactly, I think, what I'm trying to get at, is that we have these perceptions about what counts and what, you know, becomes popular and what is sort of the go-to or the black boxed kind of mic or kind of headphones, and why that happens.
Can those things, can sound quality be objectively expressed? I mean, is there a way of mathematically to say, I don't care what your brain says, that's simply better, and if you think it's better, you're still wrong because the math backs me up?
I think, I mean, there are algorithms. There's even a program now, I believe, that you can use to have your, if you have a song, it can be mastered by using like an algorithm that doesn't have to have any type of like human intervention. So I think in that context, someone might say, yes, this is objectively a better sounding, you know, piece of music. But even that, you know, the idea that quote unquote lo-fi is, you know, lower quality, I think there are people who would contest that. I think there are people who really like the sound of like cassettes. I've been to some rap shows where people only sell their music via cassette or only via vinyl or only via certain kinds of like sound technologies. And that's because they value whatever that sound is. And it's not necessarily always hi-fi. So I would say that, no, there's not really an objective way of talking about sound quality. It really does your background, your ideas about certain things color your understanding of what counts as good and bad quality.
Mm-hmm. I was at a conference just a couple of days ago, and in unrelated to the preparation for this interview, I was thinking about you because I saw an album release that I thought you would get a kick out of. A individual was releasing his album, brand new album of techno music, but was only releasing it on NES cartridges.
Wow, that's pretty incredible. That's like really niche, because I thought cassettes were crazy, but
it was completely legit. I mean, he was selling full-on, you know, 3D printed NES cartridges, and inside he had a custom EEPROM that he had set up. You put the cartridge in and it gives you kind of a almost like an 8-bit Zune music kind of a layout, and lets you go forward and backward throughout an 8-track EP, and it was done entirely through the audio of the NES, which he insisted was the best way to experience his music.
That's absolutely incredible, and exactly what I think I'm trying to get at and make sense of, that we have these very different ways of thinking about what counts as like the best medium, and people are really attached to those. I think any generation, and I'm reaching the age where I'm starting to have my, you know, back in my day type of conversations. But I think people really do feel very strongly about the medium that they listen to as a child or as a teenager. It evokes something more than just good quality, bad quality. There's like a sense that goes with it of your time and your surroundings.
So one interesting thing that surprised me at this conference is I picked up a thing called a Retron 5. It's a retro arcade. It's kind of like a SNES emulator, but it's hardware. Are you familiar with this?
No, I'm not at all.
Oh, you're going to love this. So this is, you know, I'm sure we've all done emulators. We've seen online emulators. Mm-hmm. They are in a very legal gray area.
Yes.
And by gray, meaning completely not gray at all. So a Retron is a physical piece of hardware that lets us play NES or Sega or 5, 6, 10 different kinds of cartridges. So I pick up this Retron 5, and I'm starting to learn about it, and I have to go home and flash the firmware. But now I'm actually playing my real, you know, NES and SNES cartridges. So it's fantastic. My sons love it. But the sound isn't quite right. There's a Retron.
Really?
Yeah, there's a Retron 3, which is the inexpensive $30 one, and the Retron 5, which has 5 slots. That's why they call it the 5. And it's got 10 different, it'll play Game Boy Color. It'll play all sorts of different stuff. Here's the thing though. It doesn't sound right. The 3 doesn't sound right. The 5 does sound right. So I go online wondering if there's just a fix, and I find huge message boards and threads filled with people talking about how the sound on the 3 doesn't feel right, and they don't know why.
Wow. Yeah,
you would love this. And someone actually found a way to hack it, add a capacitor, and change the flavor of the sound on the on this device so that it felt the way they wanted it to feel. And everyone else was like, oh, give me the plans for that chip.
Mm-hmm. That is beyond fascinating for a number of reasons. But I think what's the most interesting to me is it seems like people couldn't quite put their finger on what was missing. Like when you heard it or when you listened to it, can you identify what it was that was just off?
You know, that's the thing, right? It's like there are people who could be really excellent New York Times food critics, and they have all the right adjectives that are ready. And there are the people who like their Crutchfield audio magazine who say that, you know, this warmth that drops out at the low end.
Right.
I have no idea what those words are. The words are not in my mouth. you know, I'm sure they're in yours.
What's interesting, I think, is that even trained audio engineers, I've actually been reading a lot about this because I recently took qualifying exams, but on some of the same material, but they also struggle with how to talk about sound. It's still, I think, something, even for people who have like very refined ears, they have a difficult time, not just kind of quantifying, but really articulating like what a sound is or what the quality about a sound is that makes it that sound. So you're not alone.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that at some point these individuals were just pulling out the voltmeter and just saying, you know, this is how it ought to be, and maybe looking at their oscilloscopes. And it's an art, though. And this is an interesting thing. And why I wanted to talk to you is that I feel like what you're doing is a PhD that has a foot in art and a foot in science.
Hmm. Yes. I actually just talked about that today. We had a speaker who was interested actually in something very kind of different. I'd never encountered this before. Maybe you have, but this whole thinking about plants as being able to, I don't even know how to describe it, but plants having the same sort of capacities as sort of humans and animals to like respond to environments, and how that's really being taken very seriously by a lot of scientists now, and how artists have also tried to think about how we can incorporate a more holistic idea of what it means to be a plant and how a plant senses things. And so I was curious about whether there were tensions between scientists and artists, because in some of the research that I've done or that I've come across, there have been tensions where scientists feel like artists having their field be affiliated with art takes away some of the sort of scientific legitimacy. But what I'm really interested in is, I think, walking this middle line between thinking about art and how people determine what is good art and bad art, and how that is mapped onto a scientific context, like objectively what makes something quote unquote have good quality, bad quality, sound good, sound bad.
Well, there's been a lot of talk in the scientific community about why have we been siloing so many things. You know, everyone likes to have their niche. So they just draw a box around it and they point at it and they say, that's this, that's entomology, and this is the study of, and you can't, and anything else, well, I'm an expert in this. You can't, your space doesn't intersect, right? There's no intersectionality at all.
Yep. And there's, I think, within academia more broadly, there's always this sort of anxiety around labels, because they're really important when it comes to getting funding for things. Like, people want to be able to identify what your product is, what are you talking about, and who does it affect, and they want to have a nice way of thinking about it. And even in terms of framing your department, you have to have a way to market it. Like, what are you trying to have kids walk out of your program with? And I think particularly for a field like mine, we have to really think a lot about this, because science and technology studies is not something that I think high school students come into college knowing even exists. And so we have to do a lot of work in the way of like defining what this field is and why it's interesting and why kids should be involved, so we can have majors, so we can, you know, put people on the job market, so people will invest in it and we'll get funding and stuff like that. But there is also this unease with defining what your field is or what your niche is, because then, you know, there's no wiggle room. There's no elbow room for trying to do things that might fall outside of that purview.
Right. and the labels and the institutions put up over the last, you know, 50 to 100 years really want you to study and explore in this way. And if you start to take two pieces of the world and tie a string between them and say, look, these are connected and they've always been connected, the system is set up to say, no, actually, they've never been connected. And it's unacceptable for you to do this.
Yeah, it's, I feel like in conversation, that that is something that, at least in my department and in a lot of the different, with a lot of the different sort of social science, quote unquote, and humanities PhD students I've talked with, I think they are very attuned to the different connections between different fields. But it's really hard in practice, even talking to some of my like friends who have applied for grants, when they try to say, hey, my work is interdisciplinary, the people they're writing to might be coming from a sociology background or an anthropology background, and they don't want to see the other stuff. They want to see their field reflected, and why does your thing matter for their field? So it's tough, I think, trying to walk that that middle line between saying something definitive for a specific audience and then making claims that lots of different people can sort of, that can be receptive towards.
It seems like academia has a sense of co-opetition. You know, I mean, you ultimately are in competition for grant money.
Oh, yeah. Oh, completely. Yeah. It's, and it's only gotten crazier, which is part, I won't say that when I started doing music, it was like, oh, I have to have a side project or I have to have some other thing that I'm doing, because I, you know, in fact, started doing music before moving into the PhD. But it is nice, at least for me, to know that I have this whole other skill set, because the job market for PhD students is insane right now. So it's like having a side gig or a side project is a really, really good thing to have as a student, I think, right now.
I assume it would keep you sane.
Keeps you sane, but I think also gives you skills that you might not pick up in. Like there's a lot of stuff, a lot of cool things that I'm learning how to do that I would never have picked up if I were just sort of following the traditional PhD student path.
So your side project, though, and this is where I'm trying to get my head around this, it seems like pursuing a PhD would be a full-time thing. And having a music career and going on tour and recording music videos and putting out a pretty large, at this point, a pretty large body of work is also a full-time job. How are you doing two full-time jobs?
I don't know. And I actually recently, I'm part of this collective of basically nerdcore affiliated artists of color who are just, you know, trying to create a sense of community and encourage other people who are like us and have similar concerns. And so I wrote a little article about that entitled like Having Infinite Lives. And essentially it's really, really difficult. It's not at all easy. And I often and feel sort of paralyzed by the amount of work that's required for to maintain both of these identities. But it, you know, once I come down from that, I'm like, okay, I can't be paralyzed right now. I find that I just have to be really strategic with time. So, you know, when I have a break, when I have like, you know, fall break or winter break, that's time to do music. And, you know, other times it's time to write a conference paper or, you know, prepare something for a class. So it just means being very, very strategic with my time.
And you wrote that article for the NPC Collective, and we'll put a link to that in the show notes. That was written just last month. And you talked about the stress of not just being a PhD student and being a rapper and a producer, but also you were an RA and a manager at the Student Center. I mean, you've got several jobs.
Yes, it's a lot. And actually, I was speaking to a prospective student today. I took her out to dinner. And we both agreed that when we're busier, I think we're more efficient and we get more things done. Like my first year getting the PhD, I didn't have quite as much on my plate. And I think I was kind of lost, at least for the first semester. I wasn't really working on music all that much. I actually, at that point, was kind of thinking that I wasn't going to do music anymore. And it wasn't until I became sort of busier that I was like, okay, wait, let me kind of focus my time and my energy strategically. And I found that I was much more productive. So it's a lot and it's exhausting, but it keeps me motivated.
So your alternate career, your alter ego is Samus. Who is Samus for people who may not know that name immediately?
So Samus is one of the, I don't want to say the earliest, but one of the very early female characters and certainly protagonists for the system Nintendo, the original Nintendo console. And she's part of the franchise entitled Metroid, which you may have heard of.
Of course.
Essentially in this game, a game that I'm sort of drawing on for this influence, she runs around this planet in this big armor suit, and you don't know that it's a woman until she's beaten the game. Sorry, spoiler alert, if you were planning on playing it. And then at the end, it's revealed that, gasp, she's a woman. And I think when people, you know, if people play it now, it seems very dated, even in terms of graphics and the way that the game plays out. But for me as a child, seeing that, it really, really changed my perspective, because it forced me to question why I had sort of naturally assumed that this character was a man. I really was sort of struck by that. I remember my brothers being struck by that as well. So that's who the character Samus is, and I wanted to draw on her subversion of gender roles in my sort of ability to produce beats that I often receive pushback and questioning about as it relates to my gender. So,
well, and you touch on those issues in some of your music. Well, again, I'll put links to all of this at the show notes, and if you'll let me, I'll put some of your music as a backing track at the end of the chat here. But you talk about it in some of your songs, one of them called A Woman. I really, really enjoyed your Mae Jemison song, which is taken after the name of the first black female in space, also a doctor who briefly had a general practice, and one of my heroes.
Yes.
Your lyrics are really dense. There's a lot going on. As with all good rap and all good nerdcore, just when I've figured out what the last line means, you're already two lines ahead, and I'm having to go back up on Rap Genius to figure out, did she say what I think she said?
That makes me so happy, and that actually makes it all worth it, because I'm not like a particularly prolific person. It takes me a long time to put things together because I want it to be perfect and I want there to be layers. I want it to be dense. I want to make sure that each song has a lot going on. So I'm like perfecting every single rhyme, every single word. So it makes me so happy to hear that you feel like there is some quality or some depth there, because it's really, really intentional on my part.
You know, that's a really good way to put it. I mean, I don't know if intentionality is a straight up compliment, but it is certainly intended as one. Just within that single song, Mae Jemison, you've got references to Budokai, to Fifth Element, you've got references to Michael Jackson. And then within a single line, you reference both the Mother Brain from Metroid and Final Fantasy VII, all in one line. That's a lot. I'm not saying it's a lot of work to listen to your music, but it is a lot of work to appreciate your music.
Wow. Thank you. Oh my gosh. I'm getting emotional now, because I think about those moments when I'm sitting on the couch and like trying to find the exact perfect way to say what I'm saying. And there's a lot of insecurity that goes into making music, period, and releasing it. So you're sort of, after it's out there in the universe, I think you can never hear enough times you succeeded, or you did a good job, or this person feels, you know, that your work is important, or that it's dense, that there's something there. I really do want to have music that has substance in like a, you know, social conscious way, but also in like a, I think what you've been talking about, that there's layers, there's something for people who have really played games and they can draw on those references. And then there's people who, you know, haven't necessarily played games, but they know Michael Jackson, they know Mae Jemison. You know, I'm so happy that, you know, you've picked up on all of that. Thank you.
No, I'm glad. I'm glad. I think that when people hear music and they think, oh, you know, she's like me, you know, I read the same books, we watched the same shows, we played the same games. That's where that emotional connection that happens with music. I mean, a good hook will get you on the radio, but, you know, good lyrics will keep you on the radio.
Yes. Yes. And I firmly believe that. I'm really actually excited about what's happening in hip hop. I think for a long time, there wasn't necessarily a diversity of hip hop in like mainstream, but I do see that starting to change. I do see there being multiple different kinds of rap that can exist in a popular context. And that's opening up the doors for, I think, like nerdcore music to grow and for that fan base to exist in a more prominent way, because there's people who are talking about all kinds of things in rap music. And it's, I think, socially acceptable, quote unquote, to talk about whatever you want to talk about in rap now.
Do you think that the name nerdcore, that kind of genre, that sub genre, will be stifling at some point?
I think so, and I already have felt it a little bit in terms of people being confused with how to market me, or if they want to share my music with a friend or share my music with like a blog or something like that. There's always some confusion about, well, what do I say? How do I categorize you? And I think sometimes saying, oh, she's nerdcore to other people can mean, oh, she just talks about games, cartoons, and comic books or whatever. And then you're missing this whole other layer. And I think that that's limiting for a lot of nerdcore artists. Yes, they draw on, you know, specific tropes and ideas, but ultimately all of the music is really speaking to, I think, the whole human experience, because games and cartoons and video games are talking to the human experience. So I think that label it's great because it draws people to your music. People automatically are like, oh, she's into this type of stuff. I can relate to that. But on the other hand, I do think that a huge swath of the population is just turned off from it because they're like, I'm not a nerd. I'm not a geek. That's not for me.
Yeah, it does seem like every niche that is not pop music is itself limiting just by virtue of how it is labeled. And, you know, someone could say, oh, yes, well, I would definitely have Samus at my nerdcore, you know, retro arcade event or at my, maybe my company, you know, our company party. But, you know, are we going to play her on Z100? Yeah, I don't know.
Right, exactly. there's some anxiety there with what to do with me. And I feel that sometimes even going to shows and performing. Like I've been blessed to be able to perform at, you know, quote unquote nerd and geek functions that are very specific, but other venues, you know, bars, open mic nights and things like that. And I'm always thinking about my set list because there have been times when I've performed songs and been met with blank stares because nobody knows what Metroid is, you know? So it's hard, I think, as an artist, even in this genre, because you find yourself having to sometimes even produce like two completely separate kinds of music to appease two different audiences.
Yeah, I am not a musician, but this will sound weird, but I give a lot of presentations and I am effectively kind of known as like stand-up comedy with PowerPoint. So,
oh, wow. Awesome.
They're all kind of like, you know, JavaScript, virtual machines, kind of like cloud computing type things. But they are known to be, I'm known to be very funny for those people who think I'm funny. But I have to have localized versions, you know, if I'm going to speak in Sweden at a company, I got to make sure all the jokes are going to hit, you know, I could see
exactly.
You like having the explicit version and the clean version, and not just explicit and clean, but like this is a bar in Nebraska and this is downtown Chicago and this is San Francisco and a convention. Same song, three different lyrics.
Yes, it's really interesting that you mentioned that because I was having a great conversation with a friend recently about sense of humor and how varied that is from place to place and how some things don't translate. I'd love to chat with you more about that, actually, your experience trying to like tailor sense of humor or tailor your presentations to reflect what's funny somewhere and not somewhere else. Because I feel like that would be really hard. I'm pretty set in what I think is funny. So it might be difficult for me to sort of adapt to a different way of thinking about what's funny and what's not. But it's a similar thing with music, with the shows. Like, okay, here I am in front of four people who couldn't care less who Samus is. What am I going to say to them, you know?
Yeah, there is in all things, whether it be art or music or science, you have to kind of fall back on what is the universality of this thing? What is it that,
yes,
you know, if you brought up, if you know, if you're playing in Russia and they don't know who Mae Jemison is there a Mae Jemison like archetype within their space? Or is that simply a song that will never work for them because they don't have that historical context?
Yeah. And I recently performed at Geek Girl Con, and the Double Clicks, they performed right before me. And they actually recently wrote up a blog post about what it's like to tour. And I think they had some really helpful advice there, because they said that they specifically go places where they know that they can have conversation with the audience, because that's really important to their whole shtick and what they're doing. And so I think as I'm growing in my craft, one thing I'm going to have to start doing is being not necessarily more selective, but thinking more about what my performance style is best suited for. And I do think that it's best suited for a space where I can have conversation or take a break and talk a little bit to the audience and sort of a more personalized thing. I don't think I could ever do like an arena show or something like that. It just wouldn't work for what I do, because so much of it requires explanation and conversation.
Yeah. And even though you might have in your mind that success looks like 2,000 people in an arena, the more satisfying feeling might be 100 people in a very intimate venue.
Oh, yeah, completely. And as I'm getting older, I think my ideas of success are changing very, very much so. There was never a point in my life where I think I wanted to be like famous. I think I always was like, that's a little bit too much. But even now, I think what I would want is essentially what has already happened, is for people to hear some of my stuff and be affected by it. And so I can't really ask for much more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that when people say, I want to be famous, I think they're really saying, I want to be appreciated. And if you already have that, then you already are famous.
Exactly. You know what? That was brilliant. That was really brilliant. That's exactly what I think I was trying to get at. That I feel everything that I think people who are aspiring for fame want to feel. And I think eventually realize that they don't feel, because it's a different kind of beast having people have sort of expectations for you that you can't necessarily fulfill, because you've become like a character and not a real person to them.
Right, right. In the context of being online, the way I've usually thought about it, and like I have a blog that's been around for a long time, and I used to chase page views, and I used to think about it's all about the page views, gotta get a million page views. I realized it's not about the page views, it's about the comments. I would much rather have 10 comments than a million page views.
Exactly. Like, exactly.
Nothing is sadder than a post with a million page views and not a single person commented. It's just like you give a show, 20,000 people come and they all just leave. There's no encore. They're like, that was it?
Yeah. That's a really, I like this conversation about you talking about your sort of perspective on these things as it relates to like internet and your own work, because it's stuff that I think about too. Even going to certain, you know, very popular music blogs, nobody's leaving comments, nobody's engaged, nobody's talking. And so it's like, well, what's the point of having a million likes on Facebook or, you know, 10,000 followers if nobody is engaging with you? And I think a lot of artists, companies, et cetera, are running into a brick wall because for them, it's a numbers game, and it's really an engagement thing.
It is. It is. And if you have a music blog or a SoundCloud track and no one's talking about it, they're just listening and leaving, do they even really exist?
You know, there's if a tree falls in the forest, right? That's exactly, I think, especially in this age, it really doesn't exist. It really doesn't. It ceases to have existence because people are not discussing, talking, sharing. It only has a life if people kind of endow it with that kind of power. And that actually goes back to what we were talking about with how I stay sane, is I realized I don't have to post every single day and I don't have to post every single thing. If I put up things that are interesting and I talk to people who talk to me about the stuff, then that's good enough. And I feel like I have engaged with people who appreciate the stuff that I'm doing. And I found that that's really rewarding versus being stressed out and feeling like, oh my gosh, I haven't made a post today, or I haven't, you know, updated this in X amount of days. I have to do this. And then it's not fun anymore.
Yeah, no one wants to be on a treadmill like that. Well, we appreciate you, and hopefully we'll introduce you to some new people who are listening to us right now.
Oh, I'm so appreciative of this, period. Just having this conversation is really great.
Well, this is great. So you've got a new single called Crown, and you went to New York recently and did a video shoot, and I assume that video will be out soon?
Yes. So I'm actually going back again this next weekend to shoot some final stuff because the director, he's a perfectionist. He actually approached me and was like, hey, I want to do a video with you. I think what you're doing is interesting. And so I just kind of went along for the ride, and it's been phenomenal and really, really well sort of produced and well thought out. So hopefully that'll be dropping soon. I don't have an exact date, but I'm going to continue to kind of push that and promote the other stuff that I've been working on with on that same project, because I think people are starting to, like, I don't know, I dropped it in May, and I feel like recently people have been like, oh, this is kind of cool. So mm-hmm. I'm going to be promoting it a little bit more, I think.
Well, you know what will happen, of course, is you'll become an overnight success in just 10 short years.
Exactly. And just the short time frame of about 15 years, I'm going to blow up. And
there you go. Well, this has been just a joy to talking to you today. I'm going to make sure we add links to everything we talked about, including the, you know, shots from your video shoot that are up on your Facebook, and people can check you out at samusmusic.com. Thanks so much, Inongo Lumumbukasongo, a.k.a. Samus, our PhD nerdcore musician.
Thanks. Bye.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.